thank you for coming. Today, we probably don't have as long an agenda as we did last week, but we do have several people who are going to be talking with us. So I'd like to start by getting an approval of the minutes of the meeting that was held on January 23rd, 2013. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes that were distributed? Hearing none, the minutes will stand approved as distributed. You also received an agenda in advance of this meeting. Are there additions to the agenda? Without objection, the agenda is approved. Gary Tyson, who is acting as the Vice President and Secretary of the Steering Committee, will give the report of our activities since the last meeting. Dr. Tyson.
Thanks, Andy. Since our last Senate meeting on January 23rd, the Faculty Senate Steering Committee has been busy, and this report will be a little longer than the previous ones to reflect that. The Steering Committee met four times in our regularly scheduled weekly meetings, an additional six times to meet with dean candidates in both the College of Music, the College of Visual Arts, Theater, and Dance, and once with the President and Provost. In our meeting with the Provost on February 7th, President Barron joined to discuss the impact of the governor's proposed budget. The governor's budget proposes an increase in recurring funding for the university, but this is almost certainly at the cost of no tuition increase being supported by the Board of Governors. In addition, the governor's budget singles out the University of Florida for an additional $15 million to, quote, ensure that Florida has a university that ranks in the top 10 in the United States. President Barron presented a proposal entitled FSU, a proposal for enhancing excellence, achieving national prominence, and securing greater job opportunities for our students, with the goal of getting FSU into the top 25 of public universities and to become a state and national leader in student career readiness and job placement. It seeks increased funding at the $15 million a year for 5 years, with a more focused goal of excellence in STEM and to build a leading entrepreneurial university. The President and Provost aren't here, so they won't be expanding later in the Senate meeting. At the same time, we discussed several other issues with the Provost, including the slow performance of Blackboard and concerns about changing to the new Campus Solutions registration system. We have been assured that Blackboard performance should improve later this semester with the addition of new servers. We will invite the registrar to the March Faculty Senate meeting to discuss how changing the registration system will impact faculty. Since the use of computing services is increasingly impacting academic issues, we have decided to create a new standing committee of the Senate to enable us to work more closely with the Information Technology Service in the future. This is a new, you'll see this in the bylaws changes coming. This is a new committee looking at technology issues. We used to have one, we got rid of it. I think with the changes we're seeing in Blackboard and Omni, and I think what's going to happen more with the push towards online education, it makes sense to recreate that committee as a standing committee. Another issue discussed briefly with the Provost and later in more detail with the Vice President for Administration, Eric Algol, was a change in how faculty parking is allocated across campus. Eric met with us at the Steering Committee to discuss the university plan for parking and transportation, and he's kind enough to join us today, so I'll leave the rest of that discussion to him instead. He'll talk about the plans. In our meeting with the Provost, we also discussed the status of the bylaws review process that all the units have been going in. The Senate's doing. Of particular interest to the Steering Committee was the structure of faculty governance procedure at the unit level. The FSU Constitution and contract require that these procedures be formalized in the unit bylaws, but the specifics differ greatly in the bylaws of various units. One of the key issues is how membership in the faculty evaluations and curriculum committees is determined. Units across campus use everything from election to appointment with some review process. Since a significant portion of the function of faculty governance is allocated to these committees at the unit level, we must require that the faculty retain authority to determine the makeup of these committees. We will continue to work with the Office of Faculty Development and Advancement to make sure that the bylaws for each unit specify procedures for these faculty governance requirements. On a different note, the Coalition for Intercollegiate Athletics, COA, is an alliance of FBS faculty senates, including FSU. It's been asked by the NCAA to comment on the initiative undertaken by the NCAA related to the imminent decentralization and deregulation of many areas of college sports. The proposed deregulation shift includes a shift from centrally administered rules-based systems that enforce competitive equity to a local value-based system. The reduction of the scope of NCAA enforcement and replacement of the NCAA's 10-year recertification process with an annual institutional performance program, IPP program. The result is that schools will have to adhere to standards of fair play and to a significant degree they themselves define and implement. For the athletic enterprise to retain integrity over time, schools will need to monitor and force campus adherence to the core values of the NCAA collegiate model. Deregulation creates the need for individual campuses to set up and monitor athletic policies in new areas, including those bearing on academic integrity, which is the responsibility of campus faculty at most of the universities. The COIA Steering Committee has proposed the creation of a new committee or subcommittee called the Academic Integrity Group, AIG, chaired by a tenured faculty member appointed by the Faculty Senate with the title of the Senate Athletic Rep. This committee and the SAR position will augment the existing structures, including the Faculty Athletic Rep, which is appointed by the President, a position currently held by Pam Carroway. The full report is available at the COA website, which if you do a Google search on COA report, complete first link. The steering committee also discussed the impact on the faculty, this is a new item, and the curriculum of the changes to the animation and digital arts program in West Palm Beach, and this topic will be on the agenda in our next meeting with the president. Finally, we'd like to join the provost in welcoming Dr. Patricia Flowers, professor of music at Ohio State University, as the new dean of the Florida State College of Music. Dean Flowers will assume her new role on July 1st of this year. This concludes the minutes. Any questions?
Thank you, Gary. One of the big ideas that President Barron has been including in the fundraising activities and the activities here on campus is the Garnet and Gold Scholar Society, is the promotion of that society. And today we have with us Carolyn Barrington, who's the director of the Garnet and Gold Society, and Dr. Craig Feiler, director of the National Fellowships. And they're going to talk a little bit about these programs and how they can help you as faculty and your students.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Once again, my name is Carolyn Barringer, and I pretty much run the Garnet and Gold Scholar Society program. Most of you heard of it before? Okay, wonderful. I love head nodding. It was an initiative started by President Barron in fall 2010, and really its purpose is to increase student engagement and for Florida State University to become the most student-engaged campus in the nation. So I invited Craig to talk about a couple talking points, just how you can get your students involved and encourage them to become involved as a Garnet and Gold Scholar. Currently, just to give you a little bit of history, currently we have about 375 students enrolled in the program, with about 136 inductees so far. So we've done six induction ceremonies. We have our seventh coming up this spring. And so we just want to kind of give you a little background on it and just encourage you to talk to your students and provide you with more information on how you can become involved and support Garnet and Gold Scholar Society.
So as I was introduced, Dr. Craig Feiler, Director of the Office of National Fellowships here at Florida State University. It's good to see you today. The Garnet and Gold Scholar Society, I was actually on the original steering committee that created this program when Dr. Barron first arrived on campus. And it is a program that asks students to select three of five engagement areas: internship, research, international, leadership, and service. The place where you as faculty will probably most likely come up against undergraduates who are engaging in one of these areas is with research. And I know all of you do have the opportunity to work with undergraduates in research capacities in your disciplines here at FSU. And my hope today is that you will encourage the students that you are doing research with to look at this as a very viable option for them here on campus as a way to engage beyond what they're doing in their academic discipline. Now, from a very self-promoting perspective, let me say, that is a very good thing for me and the work that I do in the Office of National Fellowships, because the applications that we work with for Fulbright and Rhodes and Truman and Boren and a host of other applications ask the students to think critically, analytically, and reflectively about their entire experience as an undergraduate. I find that students are not well equipped to do this when they first get in the office, and that's fine. That's why we're there, to help and mentor them through the application process. But I will say that the Garnet Gold Scholar Society process, in a way, mimics the work that they do with us in the Office of National Fellowships and makes them think critically, analytically, and reflectively about their different experiences, both independently and synthetically, while they're here at the university. And so a student that does an Garnet Gold Scholar Society is very well prepared to do the work that we do in the Office of National Fellowships. So that's first. Second of all, the research component, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, Carolyn, is the least represented of the five. And so we really do want students that are doing research to be engaged in this program. Oftentimes, when I talk to students that are very heavily engaged in their academics, they don't think about life much outside of the lab or the library or where they're doing their particular work. And that's okay, but I think that for where I stand, I really want to see students engaging and developing as whole people, as well as whole students. And this prepares them, I think, for what comes next. The other thing that it will do, it'll get them to think a little bit critically about how the work that they are doing here at the university does prepare them for what comes next, be it going on to get a master's degree, going on to a pre-professional program, or out into the workforce. Really investigating sort of the transferable skills, I think would be the career center term, that's right. The transferable skills that the students would get as they move out into the workforce or into their graduate programs. I'll make sure I'm covering everything in here. The other thing that I am very passionate about is retention of these top-tier students. You know, we lose a certain number of students every year from first to second year, and I know oftentimes you don't get to meet these undergraduates until their second or third or fourth year, but we do lose a good number of these top third students from year to year, and one of the things that this program aims to do is to engage these top-tier students so that we're not losing students to other universities around the state or around the country because they're not being challenged at the university, and we want to be able to engage them in a way that they find to be both productive as well as enjoyable. You know, we want to challenge them, but we want them to actually have an enjoyable experience with this program and really to come away from Florida State as, with the sense of Florida State, as being one of the most student-centered universities. I do have the wonderful opportunity of working with some of the best students from around campus from all of your departments, and just as a shameless plug, if you have any, please send them my way. I would love to see them because we probably have something for them to work on in our office. Carolyn has another couple of points to talk to you about.
Exactly.
As well.
Yeah, thank you. And so, as Craig mentioned, it really does prepare them for post-collegiate experiences, whether it's graduate school or professional school or a full-time employment. So, what kind of where we take that is, we have a structured program. Students have to write these reflections, think critically about their time at FSU, the time they spent in the lab, the time they spent working with you all on the research project, as well as internships or leadership experiences that they've had. So there is a structured process where they enroll. Again, we have to deal with Blackboard as well, lots of fun. So they enroll through their Blackboard page and then they get started and they give us a plan of what they want to do. And we really encourage students to start in their first or second year at FSU just to give them enough time. And maybe try out this leadership experience. Maybe that's not working for them. Maybe you want to look into this internship in a certain area. So just to give them enough time to work towards these three engagement areas. And they'll write reflections, and then after that, they'll write the synthesis project. So that's the final piece that just culminates in their final semester at FSU before the induction ceremony and before commencement. The final piece we just want to encourage you is that the mission of Garnet Gold Scholar Society really does fulfill the mission of the overall university. We really try to push civic engagement. Service is our top area. So service is number one, research is number five. But we really would like to boost that as well. And really, we think it goes towards President Barron's recent top five ranking. So we're wanting to get into that and really help students with their career readiness and thinking about and reflecting on the experience. experiences they've had.
So I would add one last thing to that, in that I feel very fortunate that I get to mentor students over several years when I get to know them in their first or second year and work with them over the trajectory of their time here at the university. And I certainly hope that the undergraduates that you get to know beyond just the one time that you have them in a class, that you really draw inspiration from those mentoring relationships, getting to speak to the students that you work with, the impact that you have on them and their lives as students and as young men and women is just phenomenal and really invaluable to them. And I just wanted you guys to know that because I get to see them on the other side of that work. And so I know we are all just overtaxed. It seems like more students, more things, more this, more that. But do know that when you take that extra amount of time with the students, it is just going to pay dividends to you, hopefully down the line, but it's certainly so invaluable to these students that you're working with.
We left a little flyer outside on the table, so I hope you all were able to pick that up. And it has our website on it, so if you'd like to pass that information along, if you have a student in mind, or just talk about it in some of your courses, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much for your time. Yes, sir. Yes.
I do have a question, because when you talk about the range of those five different areas, and the fact that the scope of information was currently least all one of the ones that fewest number of students might actually is there a website or is there some place where we can maybe get a more detailed sense of how many of the 300-something participants are going to leave here with the name something scholar without having or getting bothered with research?
I don't think there's numbers. So you want to know the numbers, what's currently the numbers that don't have research? Or you want to know the numbers that are currently graduating?
The numbers of people that were branded as scholars without their having committed to research.
And Dennis, I can address that to a certain extent, not the numbers, but this came up in the creation of the program, and Karen Laughlin and I were both on that committee, and we both raised that concern several times. And it was the president's intent to have it be labeled scholars and have it be these five areas. So to a certain extent, we worked with the parameters that we were given. That's why I want to see more students doing research, doing this program, to give it a little more scholarship, if it certainly is the word. So my strong suggestion is honors and the major students to work with is a great place to start. The honors thesis project automatically, by them completing that, fulfills the research component for our Global Scholar Society. And so even at one semester, GIS is actually enough. We need GIS students. You know, having students who are doing research do this program, that's one reason I wanted to come today, is to have you all sort of spread that message that not enough students that are doing research that are engaging in that scholastic piece are engaging in this program. That's something I'd like to see change personally. Yeah.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
I was thinking very much the same thing. And I wonder if the president or anything would be amenable to scholarship plus two of the four remaining categories. Research plus two of the four remaining categories, and it's called the Scholar Society.
So one from column A having one item, and one from column B having four or whatever.
There are so many students who do all five, too. It's amazing. I wish we could give something, you do three, you do four, you do five, and we just haven't gotten to that part in building up the initiative as well. We're kind of still in the programming piece of it and increasing the population.
But if you guys want to throw that at him next time he's in here, please. Please do. Yeah. But I think that's very valuable, especially coming from this body.
This is more of a suggestion than a question. We use the front page of universities to kind of highlight individuals that we want to focus on. If you grab some of that for the Garnet Gold Society and highlighted people doing research, I think that might encourage people that are doing research to say, wait,
I will say, at least with the student profiles, many of those students I work with and I know, and many of them are doing our Global Scholar Society and doing research, we try and get, if you know, you read their profiles, they'll have the list of the things that they've participated in. Oftentimes that will be on there, but I think you're saying on the front page for it. So absolutely.
A lot of our students start profiles on the front board.
Anything else?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Pleasure to see you.
Dr. Barron, would you like to go now? Or?
I can.
All right.
Walking in?
We're going, with your permission or without objection, we'll change the order of business. Eric, can you wait just a minute? And we'll let Dr. Barron see his presentation.
Okay, I didn't actually have a presentation. I just thought I would come in and make myself available to any question you might have. How's that? I suppose I can just talk about different things, but I just thought, why not? I haven't been in here for a little while.
It's a question that they just posed to Craig Fowler, who's right here, who gave a great presentation regarding the Scholar Society. Given that it's called Scholar Society, why not have research as a requirement, say research plus two or other categories, rather than treating all five as equal?
Yeah, mostly I think we're letting students have some choice in the process. There have been a lot of people that have suggested that we add more categories even, like an entrepreneurial experience, given that that's another theme. But there wasn't really a thought about... I'm not even sure we actually even discussed the notion of we should make this one happen and not this one. The idea is get students engaged. We know they do better. We know they're happier. We know they get better jobs. Here are different types of engagement. How do we encourage this? So instead of trying to say, look, we want you to do this and this, it's like, you know, it could be the circus. It could be the marching chiefs. It could be a London experience. It could be all of them promote engagement and a healthier environment. So really the pressure has been to add more as opposed to be to say this one is more important than the others. But, yeah.
So to pick up on that idea, I think when the question came up just a few minutes ago, I don't think there was at all the spirit of narrowing the choices so much as keeping our eyes on the fact that we're calling this person a scholar,
right,
whether she has ever done any scholarship.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hesitation that started to blow up.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, I look at a lot of the categories of engagement as being different forms of scholarship. But, you know, we know you have to have a worldview. If you don't have a worldview, that's why the international piece is in there. And it's hard to avoid the scholarship piece of it. Service comes even with the notion of service scholars. And a lot of our disciplines feed off the notion that by providing service, you are actually promoting all those things which you're learning in the classroom and you're making them real. A lot of people think we should even have courses that are oriented that way. So, but if you want, we can go back and sit and talk about whether some of these are ones that we have to make. That we should think about waiting in some way. But our notion was, this is engagement. Makes a different kind of scholar if you do, as opposed to just do the basic requirements. Yeah.
Can you give us an update on the Bernie Meacham windfall and where we're
okay, well, okay, you know, this is my notion. I'm not trying to be rude. I think that search failed. And this was a way to, you know, I think people don't want to talk about why someone doesn't want to be president at a university in the state. So this became a door that opened to help UF move to a different level and a good reason for Bernie to stay. So, you know, my thought was, okay, that door opened. Do we get to walk through it too? There are two things that are going on. One is to follow up on preeminence. but do it as an appropriation or do it as a legislatively mandated tuition increase, as opposed to a tuition increase that we impose and that we get our trustees and governors to approve. My personal feeling is I don't want to raise tuition and fees. If I'm going to get an appropriation, I don't need to raise tuition and fees. So this is the very best thing that could possibly happen. And the second piece of this is that we have a proposal for Florida State to move into the top 25. The governor got it, our legislative caucus got it, our trustees got it. I gave it to the faculty steering committee. We're still working on it to some extent. But tomorrow I'll present it to the governor. Tomorrow afternoon I'll go to the governor's office to present this again. Both of these options work if we can get them through. My personal feeling is our legislative leaders have been saying for a long time, you know, Florida State and Florida should be going together. There's no guarantee at all that because the governor has put UF into their budget and talked about moving them to the top 10, quite frankly, I hope they get the money. I'm not the type of person that sits there and tries to pull someone off the ladder in order to get ahead. We have a few people that do kind of take that attitude, but that's not something I'm willing to live with personally. But I think we have a lot of legislative leaders and alumni who are behind us in making sure that we have a top 25 proposal. I think it's easier for us to get to the top 25 than it is for UF to get to the top 10. Too much of the top 10 is dependent on institutional reputation. They're not going to budge the Georgia Techs and the Texas, and they're not going to budge those schools, those publics. I just don't see how they're going to do it. But fine, I think they should be given license to try. And so I've been working on this proposal. If you look at all the metrics, this becomes a focus that is STEM-oriented and taking our STEM programs, all of them, up to a different level. I have tried to approach this very broadly by also including the social sciences in there, because after all, economics, political science, those are areas which the National Science Foundation is counting in their STEM metrics. We should. Of the 9 areas of STEM that the National Science Foundation keeps track of, Florida State leads in funding and bringing in external dollars in 5 of the 9. To ratchet those up has a high potential because of the way the metrics count in the rankings to take us to a level that may exceed the top 25. I've also added in there the notion that having a ranking without students that are successful is not quite so satisfying. And we understand how important careers are. This is something our governor and legislature talk about constantly. And our students are and parents are all interested in this topic. So I've also blended in there the entrepreneurial university and putting entrepreneurs in residence into every college and opening the doors of the College of Business to students from other majors. And also, I've added in there the SACS QEP on critical thinking that we're working on, with the notion that that has to have funding in order to be successful. The university has to commit resources in critical thinking, works in this job career area. I've also added a request in there associated with retention and graduation rate, two very important metrics. Right now, our retention rate among publics is number 22. It's a good number, but we're a few percentage of points above, and we're up there with many privates in terms of how successful that they are. This is a good bragging opportunity for us. And my approach to this is if a door opens and you can walk through it to get resources, then we should do it. And because that enables it when we have other resources to make sure that we maintain excellence across this campus. And I think the time's going to come with the economy where people are going to look at it and say, my goodness, we starved our universities, that didn't make sense, and the pendulum's going to swing back the other way. So if I don't walk through this door, I'll just have to play catch-up everywhere. And so my notion is just walk through this door. So the only difference is, and this will surely be to my detriment, is that there's press about UF. They're making a lot of fanfare about it because the governor has made this deal with Bernie in terms of having a top 10 university. And I haven't been in a position to say, here, look, here's our proposal for top 25, because I'm looking for endorsements first. I do know that our legislative leaders have been told by the governor that they are welcome to include Florida State in their proposals if there is legislation associated with a top 10 and top 25 university. They're welcome to include Florida State. And so that this is a good thing from my perspective. We don't seem to get out there for the press releases. My suspicion is a redo of preeminence may be more likely than a top 25 and top 10 proposal. And the money may come in the door not quite so tagged, or it may come in very tagged. I don't know the answer to that. But good or bad, I'm quietly walking the halls making sure that Florida State is going to be included. Maybe I should be making all sorts of noise about it. We have asked our alumni to weigh in. Our national board a couple weeks ago passed a unanimous resolution that the governor and the legislature should take us to the top 25 and provide the resources to do it. There are about 200,000 of them that vote in the state of Florida. If they really do weigh in, this is significant. So these things are good, but can I tell you what's going to come out the other end of the legislative session? No, I can't. But we're working two angles. So hopefully it won't just be a windfall for UF. And, you know, frankly, like I said, I am happy to have UF get extra funding. We also need it. And that's the attitude that I'm taking on. Maybe I should have a completely different attitude and just say, oh, how can we give it to those people? But it's just not in my nature. So I just hope good guys don't fend. If I can call myself a good guy. Just hope good guys don't finish last, right? Yeah.
Thank you for the work that you are doing. And I have another question answered today, but information on some further information on the bill that's moving through to tie accreditation or certification to graduates for, you know, from universities in the state.
Okay, so I'm not sure which one you're, that's tying accreditation to what?
The students that graduate, whether right. they achieve certification or accreditation in their areas.
Right.
And whether we're talking about prior to graduation, becoming information, or after, you know, like for some of the professions it would be board certification, but that's only going to happen afterwards.
Yeah.
Or are they looking at something that we could help them attain while they're still?
Okay, so I haven't read that particular bill, and I don't know the number. I'll go back and ask about it. I do know that this has been an interest for quite a while, and part of the university metrics that the Board of Governors has been collected and is reporting have been how we do on all of these tests. For anything that requires an accreditation or certification. And as far as I can tell, and the comparison is state university system only, and everything that I've looked at, we do well. So I would expect if there was some litmus test there in terms of funding or support, that we would look pretty good. But I don't, you know, I haven't gone and looked at the bill, and so before I get too carried away, I should go read that one. There's some good draft things out there, including having the 30 credits go back to 36. So there are a lot of good things out there that slowly you you work on, but that one I haven't seen a specific language for.
Could you talk a little bit more about the general ed revision with the 30 to 36? I mean, what's your take on the initiative to redo that whole?
Okay,
where
well,
we are. I mean, the provost was here last month to update.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure whether it is A, the number of good people that are sitting there like Karen Laughlin who are saying, I don't think you realize what's happening to us and how difficult this is and what we're choosing from. I think there are some people that are listening to that. It may be that some people are listening to the fact that SAS weighed in and said, this is the purview of faculty, not the purview of governments to decide on what basic requirements are to fulfill a degree for a university, and therefore, you know, you've got to get all of them to agree to the same ones, which makes it an even more difficult problem. I don't know. I was just relieved to see that it was going to be introduced to go back.
So even though the train's left the station, it's maybe backing up a little bit?
It could be. I wouldn't, you know, necessarily wait, but at least that's the draft language that is already been being worked on in the House. Anything else on your mind? Yeah.
MOOCs.
I was just on a panel about MOOCs. You know, it's kind of interesting. Of course, the crossover line is whether or not people start accepting these for credit. And I saw that ACE just decided that there were a few that they would suggest was acceptable for credit. It's obviously a great experiment. A lot of value to have things online. I think the course completion rate for all of this freeware that's out there is only about 10% right now. You're not going to build a degree out of it. I think it's quite natural to think that as a faculty and educational institutions, we want to put things out there and make sure that they're accessible. And certainly, I think some institutions are doing this so that they're part of this particular effort. I'd much rather focus on enhancing what we do in a hybrid mode and online mode in this university. But, you know, if our faculty wanted to do something like that, of course. I think we should be supportive of the state trying to do more along the lines of online education. The massive online courses, I just don't know. I'd like to watch a little while to see what happens. And do they become accredited? Does it advantage all of us because we can go pick up interesting pieces of information and teaching capabilities? I think there'll probably always be a focus on residential education, and I'm actually hoping that this blitz of online and massive online open courses allows us to be almost more residential and more interactive. It's the same thing as Garnet Gold, becoming more engaged, having more sense of community as a scholarly community. This is the reason why I want to build the Scholars and Fellows House, which is going up, is to have that type of interaction. I secretly believe that it won't be successful because there'll be no reason if we all went online for an 18-year-old ever to leave home. I just think parents will rebel at that thought. They need this thing that moves things along and helps them come of age and learn to stand on their own 2 feet and all those things. I don't think we're going to give that up just by making things accessible.
That's a fact answer I've ever heard. What's that?
Best answer you ever.
Yeah.
Could you comment on your ideas about this efficiency and value issues? Only software that my mom mentioned.
Okay, so say it a little louder. I think I'm slowly becoming hard of hearing.
The issue of efficiency and value in universities. I know President Obama mentioned it in the State of the Union address, so if that's one of the doors you could walk through, but
yeah.
It's a two-edged sword.
Okay, so, you know, I don't understand this sort of focus. When you hear it coming out of Texas, I don't know whether you've read some of the things about the regions, which would you rather have, the flagship like UT Austin, or the to Cadillac, or maybe we have to say Lexus, or whatever should be the Vogue high-quality car. Wouldn't you rather have a whole bunch of Chevrolets? Well, part of me says there's a reason why Chevrolets didn't compete in the world marketplace, and that's because you weren't striving for excellence and you weren't striving to be number one. And every time I hear people start talking about this sort of Walmart approach to higher education, I kind of cringe, because I think if you lose that drive to really be good at what you're doing and to excel, I think you're going to be in deep trouble. On the other hand, I try to use our efficiency, and of course, and I think the Faculty Senate Steering Committee, when I met with them, or it could have been Sandy, said, you know, we kind of view this as a knife edge that we're walking on, because to be the most efficient in delivering quality does mean you could just fall off the cliff there at some particular point. And so my entire view of this is we obviously know how to invest a dollar well. We obviously haven't spent it on things that don't translate into quality educational process. And so we're the place that you should invest your dollar, because we actually know what to do with it. There may be other institutions out there, and they have $7,000 or $8,000 more per student than we do, but the ranking's not different. That's not the place to invest your dollar. And so this is the argument that I make. But there's no doubt in my mind, like many, many publics that are out there, we see all the indicators that are starting to decline. Now, a lot of other institutions, those same indicators are also dropping, and you know that's a sad story, but it probably keeps us within our place. It's interesting right now, for if you like U.S. News and World Report, and of course that's a mixed thing, we're at the highest ranking that we've been at in 15 years. In that same 15 years, 46 universities passed us in the amount of financial resources they have. We know that can't go on, right? We know that can't go on. Right now, let's brag about it and see if that's a ticket for getting more funds. We are incredibly efficient. After all, what's all the news stories out there is how inefficient the universities are, and how the costs are running away. And I think the way people have done that, and the way the Obama administration did it the first go around, and we were on their list for a high tuition increase. And then you look at their list and you realize it's all these universities with ridiculously low tuition who are just trying to hold on, and they increase tuition 15%, but it's $300. And so, you know, it was clear that that was just not the way to look at it. They should have done a dollar increase. They really should have done a dollar increase. They would have gotten a completely different story out of there. And now they're focusing on the efficiency and the cost of delivery. We have to fight for this notion that a whole bunch of Chevrolets is not going to do it. And we have to take advantage of our efficiency to get the dollars that we can invest strategically, so we make sure that we can do this. Same kind of strategy: if we get a little bit of money, we put it back in the academic program. It's tough on a lot of the other vice presidents, because they're looking at it and say, okay, so money's coming in the door, can I have some? I've given the last 6 years like anybody else, and basically the provost and I have said, well, not really this time. Or you can have, you know, this much, one position or something like that. So we have to have attitude about this and use this story to our advantage because of the data, but keep fighting to go up, because we deserve it, because we've got our heads in the right place in terms of quality. We know that the schools that are doing 10,000 degrees, there's a lot behind the window in subsidizing them and counting credits that came in before and things like that. But you're never going to have an institution that's a major university be able to do that. Not without a lot of state support. The state supports you, you can do anything. Anything else?
What kind of reception are you getting in the legislature when you went around door to door with your proposal?
Okay, I think the reception has been good. They, interestingly, they're quite enamored with the fact that we've blended creating students that are more career ready with the entrepreneurial concept or critical thinking concept. They're very intrigued that we've blended those two with the investment in faculty, as it's not just enough to be high ranking, we also want to make sure that our students have an advantage. So we're getting a lot of compliments on that. I'm also convinced that there's a campaign not to include us, with people not minding, you know, saying, oh, come on, they don't, they're not, well, who knows what they're saying. But I sense that people realize that they're hearing about this and saying, you know, making comments about the degree to which we're out there fighting or not fighting and whether we're ready or not ready and whether the metrics really show that we're where we are. And so it'll be interesting, but, you know, I'm going to just continue to push on the data and the evidence and the fact that preeminence made it one time and the Blue Ribbon panel said preeminence and said FSU and UF, and I'm just going to keep plugging away at that the best I can, and we'll see what happens. So, no guarantees. Sorry if I took too much time,
no,
but
thank
I'm
you very much.
Happy to.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
The next topic on the agenda is transportation and parking, and I'm sure Dr. Barron's going to get out before the discussion happens, because we know there's danger here. Vice President, or Associate Vice President for, what is your title?
Administration.
For administration. Eric Algo is here to talk to us about the potential for changes in transportation and parking. Be kind.
Please. So, you know, I know that the topic you all really wanted to hear about today, right, parking, transportation. Since I am the Associate Vice President for Administration, which probably doesn't mean anything except bad things to most people, I thought I would at least kind of show you where I fit in. I've been at FSU for 6 months. I was previously the Vice President for Finance at Ohio Wesleyan University. Loved every day so far in Tallahassee, so I'm hoping that still stay that tomorrow. Here's the score chart for finance administration. I'm over here on the left. You can see that I have such things as police, human resources, purchasing, athletics, financials, Panama City campus, some other things, Office of Business Services, and what I'm here to talk about today, parking. So as we move forward, all of you who have been at Florida State for longer than I realize that parking isn't a problem that just happened yesterday. In fact, I've heard that compared to 10 or 15 years ago, it's actually substantially better than it used to be. But one of the realities we have to face is that we can no longer think about parking in and of itself. We really need to think about transportation more holistically. It's about getting to campus and then getting on campus where you need to go. And so I wanted to just make sure that all of you were aware of some of the options that we already have in place to help people do this, because as I talk to groups, and we're looking for groups just like this to get more feedback from, I'm surprised that people aren't aware of all of these things. We do have currently 6 parking garages, 16,000 parking spaces. Faculty and staff can get access to most of those. But that's how many we have. We have the Seminole Express bus service, which I'll show you a little bit about here in a second. At nighttime, we have many services that are designed for getting our students around in a safe manner, including cab service, our safe vans and other things. The Gotcha, the little electric kind of golf carts you see riding around that are free, usually start up late in the afternoon. We have valet parking that's available. One thing a lot of people don't realize is that the valet parkers do not actually park their cars on campus. That's all private. They take the car off campus to a private lot. So by offering the valet service, we actually did get real extra parking. They didn't just take up parking that we already had, which is kind of a nice thing. We offer the TMT transport. That's the bus service that takes students on the weekends down to Miami and Orlando and other places. ZimRide, which is a ride-sharing service, kind of like carpooling that most of us might have talked about. But it's done through Facebook, and it validates through your @fsu.edu account. So that you get some safety and security knowing that the person that you're carpooling with actually is somebody affiliated with the university, and you know who they are. And then Zipcar, our rental car program, we have several of those around campus as well. So we bring a lot of services to the table when we start to talk about this, rather than just looking at parking lots. The bus service, we had about 1.5 million riders last year. We constantly look at ways to improve the bus service. I try to ride it all that I can. It's very crowded. This year, we added a new loop. The Garnet service, which you can see the loop that goes around there, we added the Torch, which goes the exact same route, just in a counterclockwise direction as opposed to a clockwise direction. So we looked at how crowded that route was. We added, we doubled the capacity there. And each year, we try to look at those sorts of things to try to continue to make it better. For those of you who don't know, your FSU ID does get you free bus fare anywhere in Tallahassee on the Star Metro system. So if you'd like to commute from home and take the bus in from anywhere in the city, you can use your FSU card. It's free for you. The university is going to pay for you to make that commute at no charge. So we are trying to incentivize people not bringing their cars to campus by doing that. This year, we have rolled out the parking garage signs that show how many places there are on each parking garage. We've rolled out several new apps, one of which shows kind of the parking meter, or the gas gauge effect. You can just see a little bit of it there on the phone, which shows whether the parking garage is full or not. We have that in effect at all 6 of our garages. So as you're approaching the campus, hopefully at a stop sign or pulled over to the side of the road, you can glance at your phone and see which garage has some empty spaces in it so that you don't, end up going places where there weren't spaces. We'd love to be able to roll out this same technology in our regular surface lots. It's quite expensive, so we're still examining, opportunities to maybe do that in more cost-effective ways. Also, on the bus service, if you are not using it, or you're not using the bus service, I really encourage you to download this, the app. It's called Transloc, T-R-A-N-S-L-O-C. Download it to your phone, and you can see every one of our buses has a GPS, and you can see in real time where they all are on their routes. And so when you want to catch the bus and you're sitting in your office, you don't have to go down and sit at the bus stop for however long it might take. You can wait until you see the bus is relatively close on your app, and then walk down and catch it. It's quite convenient and works pretty well, although we continue to look for ways to improve it. Just of note, it's interesting to me that over 80% of our downloads so far have been on Apple devices. It tells me that our student body at least is very Apple-centric. Transloc, you can see 500,000 visits. The new parking garage, Parking Garage 6, on Pensacola, just for those of you who aren't aware, it does have 4 electric vehicle parking spots with the high-capacity charging stations, which was a new addition to our inventory this year, which I think was a very nice thing as well. So, now to the fun part. Many of you know that at the end of the fall semester, we started the construction of the indoor football practice facility of our university center. And with that, we lost about 20% of our parking, employee parking at University Center. Very significant change. And in reaction to that, we kind of threw a whole bunch of things at that problem. But one of them was this notion of moving to shared parking. In that particular situation, the students had access to over 1,000 spots in that area that we didn't have access to as employees and faculty and staff. So we had to move their lots to shared lots, and so this notion of sharing parking lots was kind of brought onto the table in reaction to that specific event. Didn't go over too well, and we've massaged it, and today, it's actually seems to be working pretty well. We're not getting any more complaints about it. It seems to be okay. So that's now behind us. We have a new challenge that we're going to face this summer. This is the Woodward and Jefferson, the Traditions Way, Wood Jeff lot. It's, some people call it the Dust Bowl lot. It's where the old tennis courts used to be. 326 faculty staff parking spaces. You can see the Student Services Building, Traditions Garage here on the left. This is where the Denny's is, just to help orient folks. And the Tanner Building is where the Police Building is. So hopefully that makes some sense in your understanding of the campus. There's a big parking lot there now that is probably the best, most centrally located faculty and staff parking lot left on our campus. When you look at the map of the entire campus, this is the one that's, that really jumps out at you. It's prime real estate. This summer, and you can see that on my the previous slide, I added the word potential before this presentation. It didn't used to be there because there are some question marks about whether or not this project is going to move quite as fast as we'd like. But we're planning for it in full speed nevertheless. What's planned to go there are two new residence halls. And so unlike over at the University Center, where we had a temporary situation with the construction of the indoor football practice facility, those spots will largely be replaced. In this case, these 326 spots just go away. They will not be replaced. And so we realized that we needed to take a really hard look at this. Just quickly to give you some idea, this shows you phase two with Dorman and Devaney Hall actually being torn down and four new residence halls constructed. We're several years out from that, but I wanted to just give you a feel for what that would ultimately look like. So in order to address this problem, we're looking at quite a few options. We are working through the Transportation Advisory Council, which does have faculty representation along with students, and it's a pretty cross-sectional group of the university to vet these ideas, and they are just that, ideas at this point. So I'm going to shut up here in just a few minutes and listen to all of you, take questions, and get your feedback. The linchpin of this idea really finds its roots in the shared parking we were forced into at the University Center. So one of the rumors that I've heard is that we're going to go to shared parking everywhere. People are kind of up in arms about that. That's not the case. We're not talking about going to shared parking everywhere. But I'll hopefully shed some light on what we are specifically talking about doing. We do own some, the Real Estate Foundation and the Research Foundation are currently in the process of purchasing land adjacent to the Call Street parking garage. I have a map at the end of the presentation, but suffice it to say it's the furthest thing to the east on our campus. Pretty remote over there. Not very popular with many faculty and staff, it's a student parking garage. We bought land next to it. We're going to put a parking lot there, about 155 spaces. Because it's so far away, that may end up being more student parking. We're still, you know, that's one of the areas that we're looking at. The Conradi building demolition is already underway in terms of abatement and some of the things that are going on inside the building. That will move forward very quickly. We're going to lose that parking lot as it sits today, about 50 or so parking spaces. But once the building is down, we will bring in 137 new spaces there. Still trying to decide whether that's student parking, employee parking, exactly what that might be. And then the Diffenbaugh lot, which is directly, it's on Copeland, kind of the Copeland, corner of Copeland and Jefferson. We're thinking about opening it up a little bit and allowing a little more flexibility in the parking there. The end result of this is if you add 155 new spaces, Conradi really less than 100 new spaces because there's already parking there and Diffenbaugh's already there, significantly less than 326 new spaces. So we, even with kind of the best case scenario we can come up with, we're not going to replace every single parking space. And so what we're thinking now is that we really want to try to open up the flexibility and the utilization of the parking garages. Today, most of those garages are student only, the vast majority, probably 90% of the spaces. We'd like to turn the parking garages into shared parking spaces. There are lots of issues that need to be discussed about this. Obviously, the benefit is that employees and staff gain access to 6,500 parking spaces we don't have access to right now. Now, they'll be in high competition. They're student spaces. So there's no getting around that. The app will help. At least you'll have that gas gauge app that when, as you're driving to campus, you can see this garage is only half full right now. So, you know, maybe that will help. But we realize that this is going to be an ongoing issue. So we're trying to vet this right now. And again, once I finish up here in just a moment, I'm open to ideas and feedback. The bottom quote here is the one that I think is a significant one. And I'm sure many of you have heard this before. I think I was told it my first day on campus. You know, any parking lot we have today at the central campus is just a placeholder. So don't get your hopes up that there's going to be a parking lot there for long. In fact, we talked about the Conradi building and a new lot there, and we talked about the new lot next to the Call Street garage. Both of those locations are already spoken for. There are already buildings planned for those spots. So even where I'm putting the replacement parking lots right now, I know those are temporary and there's already buildings slotted for those. So it goes back to what we talked about earlier, the need to think about transportation more holistically. And to that end, we are putting together, through the Transportation Advisory Council, this effort to do a transportation master plan. We have to look at this much bigger than just the next construction project, which has kind of been the process over the last decade or so. We didn't have a bigger picture view of this. And there are a lot of big questions we need to ask ourselves. What's an acceptable amount of time for an employee to have to walk once they find a parking space? What's an acceptable amount of time for an employee to have to look for a parking space? Is that different for students? Is it different for visitors? Is it different for parents? Those are all important issues. Remote parking, truly remote parking, someplace a mile or so away from campus, is that acceptable? If it was significantly less, if we could charge employees, you know, $50 a semester instead of $250 to park someplace further away and have to ride a shuttle in, was that something that we would find appealing or not? Should freshmen be allowed to bring cars to campus? These are all issues that need to be talked about in a more global context that we just haven't been able to do so in the past. So this process is just getting started, and we're certainly open to ideas and feedback. That's why I'm here today. And with that, I'm going to open it up for any questions that you all may have. Yes, ma'am.
I've heard an earlier presentation, and my question basically has to do with having people change the position from that presentation or just simply the presentation. Specifically, at the earlier presentation, you stated the Cole Street lot in Congrady would be student-only parking, not shared parking, and so that would not be a replacement for faculty. And in this demonstration, right now, the lower Diffenbaugh lot is faculty, and you're suggesting that the faculty lose access to some of those spots and it becomes shared. You also at that station said, well, we're expecting to lose a net 340 or so spaces between the University Center and the lot on Woodward, and we have no intention of ever replacing them. So my question is the difference in the way you're presenting the information, or are you actually more concerned about access faculty to parking than you were at the previous presentation?
It's not an either or question, because I am more concerned. I'm very concerned about that as much today as I was then.
Well, you said we had no intention of replacing it at that session.
So the 340 number is a combination of, we are losing about 20 or so spaces at the University Center with the indoor practice facility, combined with 326 for the Wood Jeff lot. So we're losing over 340 spaces total. So that just to clarify that number. The presentation and the wording of the presentation is changing. The decisions haven't been made yet. So that's why all I can do is kind of change some of the vernacular at this point. Certainly the Transportation Advisory Council is very aware of this situation. And the way I'm talking about it reflects my current thinking, which is the Conradi lot as a student-only lot probably doesn't make sense. and you know, that logic needs to continue to play itself out. The Call Street lot, I don't know. I'm still on the fence about that. It's pretty far away. It's just not very convenient for students or for faculty and staff, although some are happy to make that walk. But we're going to continue to vet that, and no decisions have been made at this point. Yes.
Eric, as one of the faculty members who uses the Call Street lot, it's important that you really assess whether the move to the shared lots is going to be a net plus or minus for faculty. I suspect that it would be a net minus, because even though we'll have access to so many more spots as faculty, there'll be so many more students trying to get into the spots that we're sharing that will lose. My example, I mean, my experience, my very egocentric experiences, when I come in, not early in the morning, but, 9:30, the Call Street lot has no student spots, but there are a few faculty spots in the lot. Or in the middle of the day when I go to the bottom of the pinball lot, and there are spots there, but there are no spots anywhere else. And these are places that we've learned to be able to find spots when they're very prime times. So I would really, really strongly suggest that you think carefully about this, sharing these spots.
Just to your earlier point about listening, one of the things that fundamentally changed, for example, at University Center was the initial information that went out was that the faculty lots, the gates were being removed from the faculty lots, and those were going to go to shared parking. That never happened. So to your point, we are listening to that sort of feedback, and it very may well be that by the time we get to the end of this, what we're really talking about is opening student spots up to shared parking, not so much opening faculty and staff spots up to shared parking. But I'm trying to be more judicial about that at this point.
Have you looked into improving crossroads between the College of Engineering and any campus, which would enhance research collaboration as well as maybe offloading some of the rough issues?
Yes.
I don't have to make it. I don't know what to make.
We are... We are certainly looking at that. One of the reasons we're looking very closely at it right now in particular, aside from just the reasons that you've just given, is really assessing the feasibility if someplace at Innovation Park makes sense as a remote parking site that would be very convenient to get back and forth to campus folks in large numbers, which would have a tangential benefit. But we're closely monitoring the ridership on those routes and the timing of those routes. As most of you can imagine, the only reason we don't have a bus every 3 minutes at every stop is money. We have to pay for every one of those rides. So as we see an increase in demand, we add service to those areas. All of us would like to have more frequent stops, but we just can't. We have to be careful about that. That's in the back.
Thanks for bouncing ideas with us. Thank you very much. And thanks for showing us the graphics that included a map and had a lot of bus routes on it. And I'm just wondering, I guess this is a point, what if the university said to the city, our faculty, our underpaid faculty, need a certain number of parking spaces, and our students who receive bright futures and who might be able to afford parking in a commercial lot a few blocks away on the bus route, seemed like a great opportunity for the city to build up some business, right? Some free enterprise, show up some great projects, that kind of thing, without penalizing the faculty members for being faculty members. I mean, is that a possibility?
I've got my note taker over here, so yeah, that's a. I think it's a good idea, the idea of putting park and ride locations. Maybe they're dedicated to students that are sold at a lower rate than what we would sell. That's something we could certainly talk to. We are in constant negotiations with Star Metro to improve the service, to keep prices down, all those sorts of things. One of the ideas we're kicking around right now is really dedicating 3 or 4 buses that just do the inner circle of the campus all day, so that we get it down to like every 5 minutes there's a bus that stops on that true inner core. Again, it's weighing cost and benefit.
Eric, when you talked to the steering committee last week, you mentioned that
building another parking garage on campus really was not an option right now, and it in fact had to do with our relationship with the city. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit. I think other people might be interested.
Yeah, so obviously a lot of the gains we've made over the last 10 years in parking are thanks to our parking garages. We've just increased the amount of parking so much. And so the natural inclination is to think, when's the next one going to come? We're losing spaces. Maybe we need to go ahead and do that. There's two forces that are really working against us right now. One of which is the governor's view of debt right now for universities. He doesn't like it. That's the long and the short of it. Just issued a memorandum day before yesterday to all the state universities, laying out some pretty strict criteria. You really got to think twice before you even bring forward an idea to take on debt right now. The other is the city has indicated that they are not in favor of us building another garage currently. The current garages have caused some significant traffic congestion problems, switched up traffic flows. They're just not so sure that it's the right solution. We continue to work with them and press them on that. But it's pretty clear we don't have local support for it right now. And we also, it would be a real stretch to think we have support from the BOG. So we're probably several, if not many, years away from our next parking garage project. Yes?
This is perhaps a hard question, but you know, airports and Disney World for many, many years have been able to move lots of people very quickly and very efficiently. I realize that we can. Building more garages on campus with the quote that you put, that this is just a holding place for buildings, does not seem like a very good idea. I realize that monorails and things like that do cost money. But in the big picture and in the long run, are there any universities that have gone to more progressive other than building more garages?
So this is an interesting conversation that takes place at a lot of places. Universities kind of our size and bigger, you know, that talk about we're basically small cities. Why can't we have an internal transportation system that mirrors somewhat a small city? Light rail comes up a lot, monorail systems, those sorts of things. The prevailing wisdom in the past 5 years or so, certainly since the economic downturn, is that those sorts of large-scale infrastructure projects may never happen again at the American college or university level. The investment is truly enormous. The only places that are still talking about them are large campuses that are situated in large metropolitan areas that don't have that sort of infrastructure yet. And so you get city-college collaboration, and you get a taxpayer base of 1 million or 2 million people that can possibly fund it. But a donor, student, employee base of 10 or 50 or 70,000 just isn't enough to afford it. It's talked about frequently, but nobody's moving forward quickly on it these days.
Right here, putting up new buildings would not be a loss of parking space if you included some parking floors in the new buildings. And it seems to me, you know, that this land is so valuable that it's really a sensible thing to do.
So there's certainly an effort underway to discuss the idea of including parking in the project cost for any new construction on campus. It's never happened before. So if you are lucky enough to receive funding for the state for your new science building, or you're lucky enough for a donor to donate money for a new student union building, or go on and on. We've always just assumed that building would take over a parking lot, and then parking would just figure out a way to fix that. We've never built it in. So in the Dorman and Deviney replacement project, these new residence halls, we are currently in conversations about having that project pick up some of the cost of creating at least that 155 new space parking lot. They're the first project that's ever been asked for that, though. So all of you can imagine if your academic discipline was getting a new building on campus and no one had ever been asked to fund parking before, and suddenly you were, it's not a very happy conversation to have. But we think we have to start somewhere for exactly your point. We can't just keep growing. I mean, the real estate we own is somewhat finite. And we need to be able to have people have a parking place within a reasonable distance to where we expect them to come and work. And we're very sensitive to the fact that faculty's parking needs are very different than many other employees. You need to come and go during the day. You need to meet with students in different locations. You're doing research and having meetings at home and going to coffee shops to meet with students. And whereas many of us just, you know, we get there at 7:30 in the morning and we leave at 5:30 in the afternoon, we're lucky. And, you know, it's a very different need. You need to be able to come and go in a way that we don't. And so that drives different sorts of demands as well. Yes?
This is a side issue, but that actually doesn't sound very green.
The whole notion of sustainability, that the university sustainability advisor is on the transportation advisory committee, and so the whole notion of, to answer your question directly, yes, we are thinking about it for every future lot that we create, but it's much bigger than that. Really, it's about bus service, it's about encouraging people not to drive here to campus, bicycles, pedestrian access, all those sorts of things. You've had your hand up for a while.
So I'm on the library. Has there been any discussion or is there any committee member who is from a non-traditional building? We don't really close. I still need to be able to park at 1 a.m. in the morning if I have to be there at 1 a.m. And it's a huge problem for us to have a building open with 2,000 students in it and we can't get parking for our staff and our faculty.
It's interesting, and perhaps we need to have a further conversation because I'll just be honest with you, the complaints and the concerns that I hear are not about the evening. At 4:30, those faculty and staff gates go up, and I really don't hear any more complaints at that point. So I would appreciate maybe talking a little bit later on to hear some of your concerns. Yes, and Amy's going to give me the cane
but
in
I am.
3 seconds. So.
Good.
Just a last quick point. We just say that covered bike places might be a help for these county lots, right? Because there's really only one lot, one place that you can park your bike with us that we're going. And if you're trying to draw people to the other lots and you build a covered bike racks, or maybe ones that can have a little bit of security, then people would just leave their bike on campus and that might have to use the building in place. And again, there's really only one place that you can park your bike on campus that is.
Yeah, so in fact, I have a meeting about new bicycle initiatives just next week where we're going to be talking about some of those sorts of issues, bike service stations, bike storage locations, bike. We already have a very successful bike rental program. We rent every bike we can get our hands on at this point. But we are definitely looking at those truly green sorts of transportation, fostering an environment where it encourages people to ride their bike in. The ones that I've been involved in the past work best in a very secure, centralized location where you have the ability for people to change clothes, maybe get a shower, those sorts of things. So those become very popular, but I'm not sure. But we are meeting about it and having a discussion next week.
We have other businesses. Can you make it fast?
How about parking enforcement?
Okay, so not very enforced, meaning you see people park illegally that aren't getting tickets?
Yes.
Okay. So it's an interesting thing. We, you know, despite the fact that tickets generate revenue, which we can use to pay people's salaries, we don't like to write tickets, believe it or not. It's a symptom of a problem. You know, if we have to write a ticket, it's probably because we created a situation where there just wasn't another good parking space. Shared parking, the move we've just made over in University Center, has cost us about $150,000 so far in tickets we didn't write that we otherwise would have. So we're not going to share parking with it for any sort of self-serving purposes. But the real issue is how many resources do you spend on parking enforcement in a finite pool of dollars. We can't afford to just go out and hire more and more and more parking enforcement folks. And so their focus primarily is on handicap parking spaces, loading zones, non-parking spaces, where people just pull up in the yard someplace, and then the one that I probably won't be as happy about, reserved parking spaces. So those are the kind of their first four priorities. And then they get into the lots that are kind of owned by different departments and organizations would be the next tier. And you can see it, you get pretty far down before just the general, there's a faculty sticker in a student lot or a student sticker in a faculty lot. They've already had to do a lot of enforcement activities before they get to that general level. We are certainly looking at it. One of the technologies that we're looking at right now is a plate reader technology that we can just drive through lots and just automatically see all the license plates and know who's supposed to be there and not, which we could do a lot more enforcement with a lot fewer people. So we're aware that we are writing probably 25% of the tickets we could write on a daily basis. May not feel that way if you get one. Thank you all very much.
We're very fortunate to have Eric in this position. He's very thoughtful about what he's doing, and let's thank him for it. We have two other quick pieces of business. I don't know of anything under old business, but under new business, you received or probably picked up outside a copy of a revision of the faculty bylaws that is being proposed. We're not going to vote on that today, but we will need to vote on that proposal at our next meeting. We want to make sure people receive it. You should know that most of the changes there are primarily changes related to the names of or positions that have been identified. So the dean of the faculty is now that position as identified in there is now the vice president of faculty development and advancement. There was a repeated sentence. We've added the technology committee that was mentioned in Gary's report. But otherwise, there's not a whole lot of changes that the steering committee itself is proposing. If you see of any changes that need to be made, please email me by March 11th, and we'll get that information in the version that goes out with the meeting reminder, and we will vote on the changes at the meeting held on March 20th. Any questions on that? The next item is another document that was emailed to you actually last week and that you could have picked up outside here. It's a proposal to change the statement that students and faculty have related to the observance of religious holy days to one that states that the observance is appropriate for students who are needing to observe non-work related holy days, religious holy days. We think that this will make it easier for faculty to identify the legitimate needs of students who are having to miss class because they need a non-work related holy day. The proposal, if you've had a chance to read it, does require that students identify themselves in the first 2 weeks of class that they plan to miss that particular work-related, non-work-related holy day. Is there a motion to approve this proposal? Thank you. Is there a second? And there's a second down here. Is there discussion of this? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm opposed.
Okay.
I think that saying non-work days, whatever that means, is very confusing. And in some religions, there is varying degrees of observance. And so I think we could end up having a student who really does need the religious holiday who doesn't get it. And for example, I went to your website, you know, the one that you recommend.
Right.
So they don't have Good Friday as a non-work day. Does this mean a student who wants to take Good Friday off can't? It happens to be a BBC work day. That's not a holiday. So maybe that's why they didn't put not work-related next to it. Yom Kippur is the most religious day of the Jewish calendar. It doesn't have not work related next to it, whereas other major Jewish holidays have not work related. But nobody surely would ask a Jewish student to come in on Yom Kippur. I just think it's badly flawed, and I think it's going to lead to actually students not getting time off that they need.
Jennifer, did you want to address at least the Good Friday one?
The attempt was to really make the policy or what's practice now and guess the answer, if a faculty member asked me in our office for advice about whether a student traveling to observe Good Friday services at a church was to allow that student to miss an exam in a class, my answer would be no, and has been no, and that has been the general tenor that you may observe that religious holiday, or student assignment holiday, but you may observe your religion by going to Mass on Good Friday right here in Tallahassee. The idea, I mean, we took the work restricted language from other institutions' policies just to insert that term, that modifier, into our religious holy days so that it had a more clear meaning. So the intent was to say there are some holidays where you work, work travel, any kind of activity is clearly restricted. And I just need to rely on experts who, there are experts who put together this BBC calendar to say that there are some where it really is prohibited that a person go outside after sunset, et cetera. And that's what that is just distinguishing those work-restricted religious holy days, not just religious observances, from the regular religious observances.
I just wanted to amplify that, and the way this is written, this calendar is a resource. It's not the rule.
Correct.
And that's important. The BBC, it is useful in England, but it's not here. And as a Jew, if they left Yom Kippur off, they clearly just the most important day of my life was here. So that would even devalue my own attempt in July on the BBC. But it's just a resource.
And the Faculty Senate Steering Committee recommended that that resource not be made easily available to students who were shopping for a religion early in the semester. Not that they would do that, but it is available. Yes, ma'am.
One other point is that absences, decisions about absences are always up to the faculty member. So a faculty member does not have to rest on this particular policy to grant an absence for a class attendance or an exam attendance. So that faculty member may always grant an excused absence.
Yes, sir.
How big of a problem was this, the current word, compared to why primarily funding change?
A pretty good number of questions every semester to our office. And complaints from students specifically. I would say dozens every year, and students who want to push something to much higher levels than the issue needs to be pushed to say, I want to go home for Good Friday. I always go home for Good Friday, and I have an exam at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and I live in Miami. This person must adjust his or her exam schedule for me. So that's the issue. And you really wouldn't believe how much time does get spent convincing students that their particular issue is not worth the whole administration's energy. Right.
Other discussion?
What does BBC stand for?
British Broadcasting.
Yes, sir.
I'm from the medical school, and I would just like to register that we circulated this amongst our faculty, and there were several individuals who raised similar issues to what have been raised here. What problem are we trying to solve? A. B. Should we not make our students be responsible individuals, i.e., if they're responsible to make up the work, why are we scheduling a test on Good Friday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? And can if we're talking about dozens, we're not talking about hundreds, it just seems like the language here seems convoluted, subject to people being concerned about what work restricted really means. And why within the first 2 weeks of the semester? It just seems like this is incredibly rule-written. And we're supposed to supposed to be teaching adults, we should supposed to be having them be responsible. And if ultimately the professor has the judgment, let the professor be prudent and reasonable.
Okay. Other discussion? Okay, is there a call for the question?
You don't need a call.
I don't need a call? Oh, good, thank you so much.
Which requires 2/3 vote.
Oh, okay. All right, so there is a motion to accept the policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
All right, so at this point, I guess we need a hand vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. I guess three will. Okay, all those opposed, raise your hand. Well, it, clearly, to me, it appeared that the ayes had it, but other people up on here, see?
You're the chair.
I'm the chair. The power. The ayes have it. We're going to, we'll try it out and see how it works. If there are problems, we will hear back from Jennifer, I'm sure. Are there any items of university welfare? Dr. Fiorito.
Okay, and I'll be very brief. I only have four things on my list. Number one, parking. All I have to say at this point is it was over my objection. Our parking question was removed from our faculty survey last year. I'll fight to get it back on. Item two, work on implementation of collective bargaining agreement. You haven't heard me report about bargaining because we haven't been bargaining since October, as you probably know. We're actually taking a break for change after 20 straight months, more or less, of bargaining. We'll resume in May, and we'll be talking to you about that through the faculty polls, as well as in other ways. With regard to implementation, we're meeting with the administration representatives later this month, and or I think it's twice next month. Coming up soon, we'll talk about some of the problems that come up. What else? The legislature is obviously considering some important actions, as our flyer that I left on the table outside says they're talking about things like tenure, online courses, performance funding, differential tuition, efficiencies, accountability, increased centralization of decision-making, and faculty benefits. We'd like to invite you to come to hear Senator Monford, who's the Vice Chair of the Education Committee and the Vice Chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Education in the Senate this year. He'll be speaking next Tuesday at a luncheon sponsored by the United Faculty of Florida, 12:30 on Tuesday at the Florida Room. You're all welcome to attend. Lunch is free for UFF members. $12 for others. And free for guests of UFF members, of course. Any questions? Thank you for your time.
Other items of faculty welfare? Peggy, the chair recognizes Peggy White Cleveland, who has a message from one of our senators.
Yes, I'm here representing Peggy, the College of Business, the Office of Faculty Recognition, and the Office of National Fellowships. Is bringing a Fulbright Scholar to campus on March 25th, and his name is Lonnie Ann Johnson. He's the Executive Director of the Austrian American Fulbright Educational Commission with over 30 years of field experience in Vienna, and he's a published European History Scholar. He will be giving a public address that evening at 8 o'clock, and there will be a reception to the FSU community beforehand, so you want to get that on your calendar. It's March 25th. Hopefully we'll see more announcements about that. And you'll be here during the day meeting with faculty and students if you're interested in that. Just let my office know. March 25th. Thank you.
Thank you. Other items of university welfare? Announcements by deans or other administrative officers? Provost Stokes is out of town. We've heard from Dr. Barron. Do I hear a motion to